thought it might be well just to briefly review from yesterday, because we had a major question raised on presidential power. So I've given just a little bit of a the brief review, some references that I have, this presidential powers question, the development of the Constitution, the writing of the Constitution, the branches, legislative, executive, judicial, what was said about it, the amendments to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. And then I thought today, with the group that we have, we might explore some of the issues that some that are developed already out of the Holden experience of my week, thinking particularly of our dealing with the poor and oppressed from some of our Bible studies and sermons and the lectures already. Some of the issues that relate to Alden's in terms of environment, which are always major issues in the legislature and the Congress. I'll let Alden discuss maybe the some of the legislative strategies. Pam, who has worked in Olympia and also has run some political campaigns, might have some comments to make from that angle. And then schools, which is a primary interest that I have, and also the whole idea of quality of life as it relates to the legislative and congressional process. Tomorrow, I want to deal essentially with how an idea becomes a law. And I'll take, Alden has a conflicting, you have a lecture tomorrow, don't you, opposite mine. So we had a luncheon session in which we sat down and talked about strategies and so forth, which Pam could have done too. The first thing, I have a few things if you're interested. I bring a few things each time. There is this book, Confessing Christ and Doing Politics. Have you seen that book, Pam? I don't know. Maybe you've seen it already. It's edited by James Skillen. Skillen is a Protestant Reformed. It comes out of the Protestant Reformed group, which is kind of interesting because Steve from South Africa, who's going back to be a minister, comes out of the Dutch Reformed tradition. And this is the American church. And if you're interested in doing, because we're thinking about the whole idea of political action, political activism in a Christian, from a Christian standpoint. And what I think makes this kind of interesting is the fact that it's, we've been dealing with the problem of South Africa and the problems of apartheid and so forth. And it's kind of nice to look at what is the American position. They don't deal with that issue, but they deal with the political issues in America. I think it's kind of an interesting book. And then he also, this one he has in here, an article by Hatfield out of a conference that was done. And I think that Hatfield discusses this issue of Christ's call to service, an interesting kind of note. And I think you might enjoy this because this is really what we're about, the Christian's call to the political arena. I won't take any more of that. Then he's written a book, Christians Organizing for Political Service. It does not say the church, it says Christians Organizing for Political Service. I say Christians Organizing for Political Action. Again, you're interested. Now I heard an interesting thing today, or yesterday. Delicate Balance, Church, State, and the Schools by Martha McCarthy. She's a member of a Lutheran congregation, and the pastor is here. Her pastor is here at the conference. Now I'm trying to remember, check with all the people I've met, that is, but she's at Indiana University. This happens to be a Phi Delta Kappa publication, but I have a bibliography on this. You don't need to write particularly on it. Either way, I wrote up a bibliography. She talks about church, state, and the schools. You'll see her name a good deal in the literature. There's also McCarthy, who has written in Confessing Christ and Doing Politics. This is a different McCarthy. I have a couple of little, or three little PDK fastbacks, I call them. One is on church-state issues in education, if you have an interest. The other is tuition tax credits, fact and fiction, which is kind of a controversial issue currently in America. And the other one is written Private Schools from the Puritans to the Present by Otto Proushauer. Proushauer wrote the most definitive book, The American Non-Public School. The only reason I offer it to you is it does give a good little quick history about what has happened to, in private schools since the beginning of our country. Proushauer also was educated in Lutheran elementary schools. And so it's a little piece you might want. Now the another one is Religious Freedom in America. And the only reason I bring it up, because I like to think that we present as many sides of the issue as we can. Charles Haynes is an executive with Americans United for Separation of Church and State. It was formerly called Protestants United for Separation of Church and State, now Americans United. And this, you will find quite a bit of support in Americans United among various church bodies. It divides itself. And this, but I think it's quite a good book, and talks about the wall of separation, which is one of the major issues in church, state, and particularly school issues. And you go back to the Jeffersonian wall of separation, and that particular particular aspect of it came when a Baptist minister in a Baptist minister wrote to Jefferson, asked his opinion about what he really meant, or what the Constitution meant in the Bill of Rights when it discussed the First Amendment. And so that has a little interesting review. I mentioned Stephen Ahrens yesterday in a book called Compelling Belief, A Tantalizing Case for Liberty. The only thing that makes this, I think, rather interesting, it's reviewed by Thomas James, who was Dean of the School of Education at Stanford, and then I think went back to Chicago and now is president of one of the major foundations in America. I don't particularly like James' view, you know, but at the same time, I think all sides of an issue have to be presented. And so Thomas James in this book and Charles Haynes in this one, Religious Freedom in America, give another view of that issue. So if you're interested in it, fine. It's not important, but I wanted to give you a little idea of what I've reviewed for the session. Now we come to that question that relates to presidential powers. I have one book that I've had for a long, long time. This is probably the book I wouldn't lend too easy, but By These Words, it's a book that I got from my uncle who taught for 40 years at Dana College in the Midwest, Dr. Hans Fred Swanson, now gone. But the one thing I found in this book, it has an interesting review of all the major documents in American history from the times of the Pilgrims in governing themselves in the Mayflower Compact through the Constitution, through many presidential speeches, to Eisenhower charts a change of course in his inaugural address in 1953. It's a fascinating book, and I used it particularly last night as I was attempting to review the delegation of presidential powers as it's outlined in the Constitution. And so that book has given me a lot of good, healthy thought, provocative thought over the period of over a period of years, frankly, but most recently as I was preparing for this particular series of events. Now, a more recent book which I like is The Constitution, That Delicate Balance. It was written by actually two media people in a way. Fred Friendly is in television, and Martha Elliott's in journalism. Now, here's where we'll start on this question on presidential powers, and it helps define the delegation of powers as they started to write the Constitution on May 14th in 1787. May 14th, men gathered in Philadelphia, a few at a time. They drifted in, so to speak, and of course by the end of the year, approximately, I'm trying to remember the date when they finished meeting, but they had accomplished the objective. There were two plans, one called the New Jersey Plan, and the other was the Virginia Plan. The New Jersey Plan was to amend and try and see what they could do with the Articles of Confederation to try and improve them. And so that was the debate. That's what started it. And the men from New Jersey coming to the conference started to present their plan, and eventually the Virginia Plan emerged as the one that they used substantially to modify or to write the new Constitution. The debates were fairly heavy, too, in that in those early days about presidential power. They didn't want to elect a king. They didn't want an emperor. They wanted a president who had certain kinds of limited powers. Now, this Friendly and Eliot discuss this particular area, and I want to start to somewhat describe what happened briefly to indicate the development of the president assuming certain powers. They're really war powers. It started in 1854. Up to that time, the president exercised, there wasn't quite as much reason to have the problems that existed. And a war, you know, you look at the War of 1812, you look at the First World War, the Second World War, very definite kinds of reasons for Congress and the President to enter into that kind of thing. In 1854, there was an obscure incident in Nicaragua, which almost caused a war at that time with Great Britain. Franklin Pierce, who has gone down in history as really quite an ineffective president. If you take the rankings, he would not be prominent. However, we have a county that we live in Washington named after Franklin Pierce. We have Franklin Pierce School District surrounds Pacific Lutheran University. So he had, he's remembered, at least in our own local way. Pierce was attempting to work in other areas in terms of even the Monroe Doctrine, and this topic comes up so frequently now. It came up very often when we were relating to Cuba, and Russia was bringing missiles into Cuba and starting to bring a lot of people there. And it's had in Central America now, and particularly in Nicaragua, El Salvador, and some of those areas, and so that topic comes up again. But anyway, Franklin Pierce sent troops to take care of a problem. It was really an economic one. Someone was offended down there, and in an incident that should not have caused that much trouble. However, he sent troops without permission of Congress, who currently was in session. That raised quite a serious issue at the time. And he himself, as I'm sure most presidents, trying to figure out what he should or should not do. And that's, of course, how presidents get into this kind of difficulty. So that was the start of it. And then there is a reference to Jeffersonian policy, because Thomas Jefferson himself had a very strong and fiercely held position that the president should not act without consultation. But even in his administration, he reported to Congress that an American naval schooner had been fired upon, and went ahead with the American Navy to counterbalance that, unauthorized by Congress too, but not a major concern. Now let me get down a little farther into the power to make war, and then we get a little bit more into Jack's question of yesterday. The question might ask, had Pierce usurped Congress's war-making powers? In other words, the Congress was the one that had the authority to declare war. And so any time a president stepped in as commander-in-chief of all of the armies and acted on the basis of what he thought was right for American policy, then the question was raised. And I'll read you some, just a few articles that have appeared relative to what our current situation with the incidents in the Mideast as well as in Central America. Madison took the best notes that were taken at the during the Constitutional Convention discussions, and it was his in his notes on the debates relative to the power of the executive. He did not want the executive to possess powers of peace and war, lest the office assume tyrannical powers of monarchy. And it's interesting, Friendly and Eliot put in the discussion that took place during the Continental Congress, which I think are kind of quite interesting. So from the very beginning, there was a very great concern about the powers of the president. Now, Schlesinger, writing in another area, feels that and writes that the Founding Fathers were influenced substantially by John Locke. Now, in my bibliography, I have also included the letters of John Locke. They are very ponderous and very heavy to read. But John Locke, as a political philosopher, did have a great deal of influence on our Founding Fathers as they were writing the Constitution. In terms of the extraordinary uses of power as it related to the president. Now, in 1972, Senator Javits, Eagleton, Senators Javits, Eagleton, and Stennis introduced a war powers bill into the Senate. Does anyone remember that? And it followed for what reason? Substantially based on the Vietnam War. In other words, people were very disturbed about what Presidents Kennedy, Johnson, and finally Nixon had done as it related to the Vietnam War. And they felt there was a need to introduce legislation that would limit that power. Eagleton wrote a book on it. I'm trying to remember the name of the book that he wrote. Senator Eagleton wrote a book on that particular aspect of presidential power. The doctrine of executive war powers had been erected for nearly 200 years. And and for this reason, the Congress felt it was necessary to do something about it. Presidents Nixon, Ford, and Reagan have all asserted that that act was unconstitutional. Rather interestingly enough, coming from that side. And so you can see some of the reasons why we are in the situation that we're in. Tom Wicker, a journalist, in his writing, indicated that he felt that it had given the president more power than he had before. I don't necessarily debate that, but that's a comment that Wicker made. Now then, finally, who decides? And then I'll just leave it at that. Then we can ask some questions about that before we go on. Who decides? In our scheme of separation of powers, there remains the question of who decides where the war powers lie. Who decides whether the president has exceeded his constitutional responsibility to keep troops in action longer than 60 days? Or whether Congress has put an unconstitutional restraint on the president's use of emergency powers, or his power as commander-in-chief? That's the major debate that exists now with President Reagan's use of force around the country. Who can then decide in these issues? The Congress, the legislative power, can veto, can override a veto of the president by 2/3. The place, however, where it can be cited is in the Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court. I didn't realize that until I read this. If Friendly is correct, I'll just give those three bases upon which the court can enter in. But under the principle of judicial restraint, the court can decide that certain controversies between branches of government exist, and that between the executive and the legislative. And there are three basic rationales for the court to invoke that doctrine. First is that the Constitution does not give the court final determination on all constitutional questions. I think you've heard that in the news occasionally. That's the first. The Constitution explicitly commits power to act in certain fields to the executive or the Congress. That's the debate. And finally, the third rationale is that some controversies invite judicial restraint. That is, some issues are too controversial for the court, and the court would have no power to enforce the decision they have made. Now we'll see, and I think essentially, it doesn't fully answer the question because I think it is not fully decided. And I think that any one of the branches would have to exercise its authority as defined in the Constitution. I don't think I'll go through and read that so carefully, but that I've read the Constitution. I read the powers of the Congress, the Senate, and the House, the powers given to the president, and I think there is a shadow in there, and even with the War Powers Act of 1972, the Boland Amendment, of what year I can't quite remember, but it was in the 80s, that the president has acted, and it is up to Congress and or the judicial to exercise its appropriate check and balance in that area. Now, Jack,
there's a one thing here that was kind of interesting.
Over the last few months, I've been clipping a little bit as it related to this topic. I'm a great newspaper clipper anyway. I think I get that from Nesbitt's book. He had many, many sources of the media, particularly newspapers. And he only took first-hand accounts. He didn't take second-hand stories or third-hand stories. He took mainly first-hand accounts, and he
took those trends throughout America and named states that were trendsetters and so forth. So I've become quite a newspaper clipper of three or four or five newspapers. Well, looking ahead here a few months into this, where I started clipping a bit on some of the issues that I thought might come out. And here is one in the Sunday News Tribune of May 24th, which isn't that long ago. And it says, Reagan's Iran-Contra rule fuels national debate, which it has. That's an understatement. And so George Will, as you well know, as a conservative writer, indicates Reagan operated well within limits of Constitution. So that's one journalist who makes a statement on it. And in here, he writes, the Boland Amendment does not cover the president's office, which includes the National Security Council. That's been a major debate around the country as to whether or not that Boland Amendment covers the president. And of course, you know, in politics and in government, if there's a way to work out of a situation or through a situation that doesn't cover me, you're probably going to do it. And they have a nice article here of Constitution of the United States, Article 2, Section 3. The president shall take care the laws are faithfully executed. So he has some Ollie Norris shooting a hole through the law of the Boland Amendment, which is, in a sense, what happened. And so that I thought that was kind of an interesting comment. Now, I could spend a little time on this. History says, too, there are more than 140 instances of presidents sending troops in harm's way or sending war material abroad without Congress's permission, beginning at least with President Adams sending the Navy to capture 90 French ships and land Marines in Santo Domingo as retaliation for France seizing U.S. merchant ships. I think that's where it started. Then Franklin Pierce, and then sending troops abroad. The Korean police action, the Vietnam police action, the sending arms to Iran. I mean, all of these kinds of things. And I believe that there's something to be learned by all of it in the study of the Constitution would be to go back to what I think were some basic principles laid down. That was that the President of Congress could make those kinds of decisions. As I look at it now and review it or evaluate it to some degree based on the little bit of knowledge and study I've tried to put into it now, from a more from a student standpoint than from a practitioner standpoint or a lobbyist standpoint, that very likely the Constitution contains the elements still, and I say as a living document, to allow that to take place. And I as I look at the actions of the executive, and that's whether it's Democrat or Republican or otherwise, it seems to me to be so sensible, communicate with one another and confer and make decisions that seem to be less political and more sensible, at least when it comes to the concerns of people around the world. And Jefferson, I think, tried to lay part of that that idea. I think that Will goes on to say, and quote, and he quoted from David Brinkley, which is interesting again. The principal objective of the Founding Fathers was to prevent the accumulation of despotic power in any individual or institution. They were principally concerned about the presidency. They did not want the president to be a king. So they dispersed power. They separated power, and they did not give the president exclusive authority to conduct foreign affairs. That was the aspect of it. They placed enormous power in the Congress to check the authority of the president in that regard. There's no question that was their objective, and Brinkley Riley observed they didn't want a George III,
and did not get one, or a Ronald the First either. And I thought it's kind of a humorous end to that particular article. But that is somewhat clarifying. At the same time, it still does not clearly. I have always felt, as I reviewed the actions of a legislature, a Congress, or any other, that the legislative power was vested with the House of Representatives and the Senate. In spite of that executive power, leadership, we have to have from the president, and they can make those changes or control and limit those decisions that are made. Now, William Safire, who I think is also concerned, I don't know why it happened, these are the ones I picked up, because he's certainly more on the conservative side too, but he says the overlap of constitutional powers works well. Well, I'm not so sure this works so well in these kinds of situations, but those were a couple of references that I picked, at least out of the current literature, to relate to the more fundamental questions that we have. And I may want to make a comment. Alden, I know you had a comment on it, but I passed by. Did you have some comment to make?
Well, that was back a ways. We were distracted from what you were saying. We're distracted so clearly that we have this single sort of unity of life here, but yet you have administrative and constitutional things happening both at once. And that's where the arguments and where it needs the clarity in sorting out which is a constitutional issue, which is an administrative procedure. And that was one comment I had at that time. It just struck me. And I have one other thing now, that regarding the president's office the last 5-6 years, particularly the last few years, the main research center in this country on civil liberties law, Mitchell John Civil Liberties Institute in Berkeley, and the head of that is professor of law and constitutional law person, and the lady around the country, well, that's Ann Ginger Wood. They have listed 38 violations of law by the Reagan administration. That includes the United Nations Charter, which is the law of the United States by congressional action. So that's one side of it, and you seldom hear that put forward.
Yeah, I suppose I suppose you get in somewhat into the politics of the situation, the feeling of the country too. It's amazing that, not so amazing, but President Reagan still shares a very large popular support. It went down substantially, it's an Iran gate thing, but still, it's about a 50-50 proposition in most polls. And I suppose that's why it's very difficult for that to emerge and as a critical matter in opposing presidential executive power. I don't know, Pam, do you have any comment on, from your view of the political situation? Jack, you do have, now take some comments on it, because I still would like to. I think that is very true.
Yeah.
Much more fragile than we want to admit. Yeah, I think that's a good point, Jack. I think that, but I'm glad you brought that up, because it does force us into a pretty serious consideration of what that means in terms of writing the Constitution. Some people have indicated that it's to the extent that it's a living document, that it does change, that we have the power still to make those kinds of changes. And my concern is, my concern over a period of time has been, are we developing the educational resources, the kind of balances and understandings in our country that allows us to do that? I mean, we're increasing an illiteracy, I mean, in a sense in our society, where are we going to be able to even understand the differences? In fact, the knowledge about the Constitution and so forth is quite limited. And it probably should tell us we better get back. I guess that's why I have schools as one of the major issues, and always will. That's why I'm in the school business, because of the fact I feel that that is the place where you have to teach children their basic, the basic knowledge about their institutions and about their. There's been increasing, I think, and let's say in the last 50 years, the increasing presidential power, starting with Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, if I were to look at history at the time that I can remember and am aware, that presidential power has increased and generally increased based on war. And that was the one power that was pretty carefully delineated in the Constitution, were the war powers of the president. And then we started to limit those. And when we're talking about economic matters, and did you bring up, Jack, in your Bible study about the whole that economics is so much back of the problems that relate to oppression? But yet again, if we have to look at the economics, what's back of the economic system and balance of our country is war, almost going back to the Revolutionary War. In other words, it's been which is really unfortunate, that the kind of ups and downs of our economy are based on wartime. Well, that's kind of a sad commentary on our society, which leads, I think, to a very important thing that you've said, Jack, is that there probably is a need for a great transformation, a great transcending of what exists. But I'm not so sure that the documents and the ability to amend that Constitution do not exist without going to necessarily a constitutional convention, which a lot of people in America are calling for.
But you think it is possible without a constitutional convention? You don't
think? I think it's within the power of the Congress and judiciary to do it. But I don't believe that the Congress has the guts to do it. And I don't think whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, I don't think they want to lose that great power that those individual representatives and senators have. Then it comes back to politics, and some people articulate, is the party, and some of the authors that I read are saying, is the party system that we presently have sufficient to deal with the needs? It may well be that that's because we're developing a large middle. In other words, there's a increasing independent number, and that they will select the side that seems to satisfy them the most. We are moving out of time. I would like, are there any comments from our audience? I mean, I know you're in political science from Whitman College. Do you have any comments to make on the discussion so far? I think it seems to me one of the real problems too exists is that I think I don't have in my own mind that President Reagan, nor maybe even Ollie North, were malevolent in their, I mean, one was, in my own mind, I think the system that's developed without the Congress raising the voice has led to that. They have not restrained, in a sense, nor the condition. Some people have some suggestions about terms of office. I read I'll read you another interesting, and I picked out two out of I've read the Tribune. I read about four newspapers, and I read innumerable periodicals. This happened, however, to come out of the News Tribune, which is our own. But they asked presidents Nixon, Ford, Jimmy Carter, particularly, and they've asked a whole range of people on the kinds of things that they would favor. And one of the issues was Nixon would like to lengthen the term of congressman. Gerald Ford said he'd like to repeal the amendment that relates to the limitation of presidential terms. But Carter came up, I think, with probably the best suggestion, and that was elect presidents for 6 or 7 year terms. In other words, give them enough. He didn't talk about either one, but if you notice, we have not had a president that's been able to serve two terms since who's last in Eisenhower, and now Reagan. But in between now, we have not had a president who has served a full two terms. And then, of course, the reaction was to Roosevelt's three-term plus the fourth term he was elected presidency. Any other comments that you have? I don't know, Roberto, anything in Central America that would be
pertinent to our situation. Yeah. As the chief representative from some years back of Guatemala, would help. The final area that I want to take a bit today, I want to talk maybe on Saturday when I have a session about the Supreme Court and the Bill of Rights. But I thought, what are the issues? Do you have any feeling for the issues that we might look at from a legislative standpoint? Tomorrow I'd like to go through the process of how you take an idea or a thought to the governor's or president's signature. And as I say, some of the ideas that came up, I was thinking about, at least in terms of the poor and oppressed, what are some kinds of legislative initiatives we should be thinking in that particular vein. Do you have any feeling for that area? One I feel, of course, is education, that we need to improve our conditions and opportunities to make sure that we have children literate, able to read, write, figure, think, vote. I think that's one area. Right, I think we're dealing with that. I think that's one of the problems we have right now. It isn't that the teachers don't want to, but I think we've had a problem with prioritizing the right things. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead. Now, where are you from? Just to go. Oh yeah, good. Okay. I think the school has been forced to take on some major social responsibilities that we have to look at how we're going to deal with that. And so I guess I'm trying to define a legislative agenda that might utilize other resources. Schools, interestingly enough, become rather jealous of their prerogatives and sometimes feel, I think, that they may be the only institution that can deal with children and young people. I think there are others who can.
It's going to be tough because you have to look, what is the major problem, what is the major concern with schools today? You have kids that are graduating and they can't even read on sixth grade level. Mm-hmm. So you're asking them to learn something.
That's right.
So they become teachers and they can't read yet.
Yeah. I think there's been massive infusion of something at the lower levels.
Priorities. Yeah. You really have to take a look at priorities. Get back to some of the basics.
That's a tough one, and in fact, but I feel that if we can't, and I sometimes think if there is an evil design, if there's anything malevolent in our society, it might be on the part of those who can make it possible are not doing it in terms of funding and providing the opportunity. Now, we're spending increased money every year. 1965, we started the Great Society legislation. With Lyndon Johnson, we started infusing great sums of money into the public school system. And I think some of us feel that too much of that went into administration and carrying it out and went into actually programmatic kinds of things. But it is interesting that every time you set up a program, you have to establish so much hierarchy and paperwork to accomplish the objective. Our time is really becoming limited, but I'd like to explore that in the next. I'd like to explore that a little bit tomorrow, if I can, in terms of how we would accomplish objective. I was trying to get some things. The other thing I'm concerned about is health and medical services for the less people less able to provide that. I have felt over time that it's unfortunate any child in our society has to suffer. In any sense at all, for a lack of health and medical kinds of facilities. I think we should look at that in terms of people. The other area would be in terms of jobs and vocational training
other than just purely educational.